You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Welcome to the Age of Napoleon. Episode 31, The Walls of Mantua. Thanks for joining me. We left off last time in early August of 1796. Napoleon and the Army of Italy had just won an important victory at the Battle of Castiglione. Earlier that summer, the French had succeeded in pushing the Austrians almost entirely out of northern Italy. The Austrians launched a counteroffensive, led by the ornery but experienced Field Marshal Dagobert von Wurmser. His objective was the last Austrian foothold in Italy, Mantua, an imposing fortress city which held a garrison of 12,000 men. Napoleon had taken a big risk by lifting the siege of Mantua so he could bring his entire force to bear against Wurmser's superior numbers. That gamble paid off in the victory at Castiglione. However, leaving 12,000 men unchecked in his rear had come with consequences. Valuable equipment left behind at the abandoned French siege lines fell into Austrian hands, including much of the Army of Italy's heavy artillery. Worse, after Castiglione, Wurmser belatedly succeeded in his mission. After the battle, a small detachment from the Austrian field army was able to make contact with the garrison. If it had happened only a few days earlier, this could have been the turning point of the whole campaign. But Wurmser's army was fully in retreat, and Napoleon was already moving to restart the siege. The chance for the field army and the garrison to join forces for any significant operation had been lost. But the fleeting contact wasn't a complete waste of effort. The Austrians delivered valuable food and supplies to the city, and evacuated sick and wounded men from the garrison, replacing them with two brigades of fresh, healthy soldiers. This brought the total strength of the Mantua garrison to over 17,000 men. This accomplished, the men from the garrison returned to the city, and the soldiers from the field army left to join the retreat. Wurmser had failed to break the siege, but despite his defeat, he had managed to disrupt the French efforts and bolster the defenders. So, strategically speaking, the offensive was not a complete disaster for the Austrians, despite the fact that they lost every battle. However, I think this just goes to show how misguided the Austrians were to focus so single-mindedly on Mantua. What had they actually gained by reaching the city? Delivering food and evacuating the sick was a big help, but the overall dynamics of the situation hadn't really changed. Wurmser was defeated. He and his army were in retreat. It was obvious that the siege of Mantua would soon recommence. True, the action of late July and early August had created slightly more favorable conditions for the garrison, but in the grand scheme of things, the Austrians were back at square one, with the garrison bottled up inside the city and Napoleon in control of the rest of northern Italy. Historians differ on how many men Wurmser lost in this effort, but estimates run as high as 17,000. As we've seen, the sizes of armies in this era could fluctuate quite a bit, but that significant numerical advantage that Wurmser had enjoyed at the start of his offensive had been effectively erased. So, by focusing so intensely on Mantua, the Austrians had gained a little and lost quite a bit. While Napoleon secured northern Italy and faced down Wurmser, the Directory and War Ministry back in Paris were busy formulating a new grand strategy. This would have implications for Napoleon and the Army of Italy, but to understand exactly what they were thinking, we need to take a moment to zoom out and take a look at the broader picture. The last time we looked at the wider war, the momentum had finally tipped in France's favor. Prussia and Spain had dropped out of the war, and pro-French revolutionaries took power in the Netherlands, leading their country out of the coalition and into an alliance with France. And of course, as we discussed at length, Piedmont had been knocked out of the war as well. Worse for the coalition, Spain and France were on the verge of rekindling their old alliance from the days before the revolution. The Spanish Bourbon dynasty and the French revolutionaries who had killed their cousin, Louis XVI, made very strange bedfellows. But Spain's geopolitical interests drew her naturally into rivalry with the British and friendship with France. Whatever their ideological and personal animosities with Paris, the opportunity to join the winning side of a war against Britain and Austria proved too tempting for Madrid. On August 19th, 2 weeks after Castiglione, the negotiations were completed. Bourbon Spain and revolutionary France became allies. Despite Bonaparte's victories and obsessive publicity campaign, the Rhineland front remained the main priority for both sides. To put the disparity between Italy and the Rhineland in perspective, during the First Italian Campaign, the total strength of the Army of Italy will peak at around 60,000 men. Around this same time, France had nearly 200,000 troops in southern Germany. These were divided mostly between two field armies, both named after rivers. The Army of the Sambre and Meuse operated in the northern half of the theater, under the command of General Jean-Baptiste Jourdan. To their south was the Army of the Rhine and Moselle, under the command of General Jean-Victor Moreau. If you'll recall our episodes on the Terror, the position of army commander became a bit of a revolving door in the French military. Senior officers were sacked, or even executed, at the drop of a hat, and many others deserted or defected. The average tenure of a commander-in-chief during the Terror was only a few months. It had taken time to bring that period of chaos to an end and settle on new, capable leaders. But by mid-1796, that process was more or less complete. Both Jourdan and Moreau were top-notch generals. Obviously, neither one was a once-in-a-generation genius like Napoleon, but they ranked among the best in Europe. We've met Jourdan in earlier episodes. He was the one who led the Army of the Sambre and Meuse through the successful conquest of the Netherlands the previous year. General Moreau had taken over command of the Army of the Rhine and Moselle at the worst possible time. His predecessor was a closet royalist who had actually been caught using his position to secretly aid the coalition. In the face of this stunning turn of events, Moreau managed to pull the army together and organize a fighting retreat back to France. The two armies crossed back into Germany in the early summer of 1796, right around the time Napoleon was setting up the siege of Mantua and extorting the treasures of central Italy, episode 29 by our reckoning. Unfortunately for the French, Moreau and Jourdan faced much tougher and better led Austrian opposition than Napoleon had down in Italy, and neither man was as quick or imaginative a general as Bonaparte. But, despite some setbacks, they made slow but steady progress westward from the Rhine. By early August, around the time Napoleon defeated Wurmser at Castiglione, Moreau had pushed deep into Bavaria, almost clear across Germany. This offensive wasn't a virtuoso performance like Napoleon's. There had been defeats and false starts along the way, but in 4 years of war, the French had never pushed this far east. East of Bavaria was Bohemia, a region ruled directly by the Habsburgs, and one of the largest, wealthiest provinces in their empire. Southeast of Bavaria lay Austria itself, the very seat of Habsburg power. If the offensive continued at this pace, Moreau was poised to deal some serious damage to the Austrian cause. Back in Paris, the war planners finally allowed themselves to believe the end of this bloody, ruinous war might be just around the corner, and they began drawing up plans to realize it. For obvious reasons, they pinned all their hopes on Moreau. And so, word came down to Napoleon to turn his attentions north and push over the Alps into Austria in support of the next phase of Moreau's offensive. Bonaparte was not thrilled by this new strategy. As you may have noticed by now, he generally bristled at taking orders from anyone, regardless of their content. But he did have genuine practical reservations as well. On paper, Moreau and Napoleon's armies were not terribly far apart. As the crow flies, the two forces were separated by under 300 kilometers, or about 180 miles. But those 300 kilometers include some of the roughest terrain in Europe, the very heart of the Alps. The Austrians controlled the passes, and there was no provision made for the two generals to communicate with one another. So there was really no way for Napoleon and Moreau to launch a truly coordinated offensive. In essence, the Directory was ordering them both to make independent attacks around the same time, and just hoping they would be able to link up and synchronize their movements once things were already underway. Napoleon knew very well how such poorly coordinated movements could easily lead to disaster. As we've seen, he had been that disaster for the Austrians several times when they went into battle with divided forces and vague plans. There was also the question of weather. The French had fought winter campaigns with some success over the course of the war, most notably in the Low Countries, when they took advantage of the frozen Dutch rivers and canals to great effect. But Holland is flat, densely populated country, with good roads, and not too far from France. Fighting through the cold season in remote mountain passes hundreds of miles from Paris would be a different matter entirely. Not even Napoleon was optimistic about his chances in those conditions. And by now, it was mid-August. In this part of the world, at high altitudes, the frosts began in September. There were also strategic issues. Mantua remained as a thorn in the Army of Italy's side. Even if the siege proceeded smoothly, it would be months before they might expect a surrender. And of course, Wurmser was still out there. Napoleon had no illusions that Castiglione had been a big enough defeat to keep the old field marshal from attempting another offensive before winter. But despite all those doubts, Bonaparte decided against arguing with Paris this time. He prepared the army to march north, into Austria itself. However, Napoleon left nearly a third of his troops in the Po Valley, perhaps reflecting his misgivings about this mission. Around 6,000 men would stay behind to maintain the siege lines outside Mantua, and another 3,000 under General Edward Jennings de Kilmaine took up positions along the Adige River, where they would guard against the possibility of an Austrian offensive from the east. Napoleon began his advance north in late August, and immediately discovered there would be one last item of business before he left Italy. Wurmser had rallied his forces much quicker than expected, and was already in the preliminary stages of another offensive. You have to give the Austrians credit. It had been less than 3 weeks since they narrowly avoided annihilation at Castiglione, losing perhaps as many as a quarter of their number killed, wounded, or captured in that failed operation. And yet, here they were, already back in the field and on the march, with an entirely new plan of action. But it was all for naught. Yet again, the Austrian leadership had completely misjudged the situation. They believed the offensive of early August had been nearly as devastating for the Army of Italy as it had been for their own units. Given that the Austrians started with a much larger force, they felt it was reasonable to assume Napoleon was badly weakened and would be unable to undertake any major maneuvers for some time. Perhaps this belief helped nurse some bruised egos in the Austrian high command, but it simply had no basis in reality. During the Castiglione offensive, Wurmser lost more than three times as many men as Napoleon. Significant amounts of artillery and supplies had been captured by the French. Austrian morale had suffered badly. Some units had lost cohesion entirely. This was not the case for the Army of Italy. But, blissfully unaware for the moment, Wurmser once again divided his army into two columns. This time, the main body of his army would approach from the east, supported by a smaller column under General Paul Davidovich approaching from the north, along much the same route he'd tried a month earlier. Meanwhile, Napoleon and his men entered the mountains. The crossing of the Alps was brutal. As always, the Army of Italy was lacking in clothing and equipment, and the men suffered terribly. At the beginning of the campaign, General Massena estimated that 2/3 of the men in his division lacked either shoes or basic items of clothing. It may have still felt like summer down on the plains of Italy, but in the heights of the tallest mountains in Europe, it was practically winter already. It's ironic. At Castiglione, Napoleon took huge risks, moving heaven and earth to create the opportunity to attack an Austrian column in isolation. Almost exactly a month later, he stumbled upon another such opportunity without even trying. As the army of Italy began its advance north into Austria, they blundered into Davidovich's column, headed south for Wurmser's new offensive. Massena's division made the first contact on September 4th, near the town of Rovereto. Finding the Austrians completely unprepared, Massena immediately committed to an all-out attack. Davidovich didn't stand a chance. He was taken completely by surprise and outnumbered 2-1. His tired, demoralized troops fought poorly. The French overran the main Austrian encampment just as dinner was being served, and feasted on the enemy's rations. In the Battle of Rovereto, Davidovich lost around 3,000 men, killed, wounded, or captured, along with much of his artillery and a good deal of dignity. The French suffered only around 700 casualties. Davidovich fell back as fast as he could, and the next day, the French marched into the city of Trent without resistance. Trent was the first major Austrian town north of the Alps, so this was an important milestone towards establishing a foothold on the far side of the mountains. After he learned of the disaster at Rovereto and Napoleon's advance to the north, Wurmser decided the best course of action was to continue his offensive. That might sound crazy, but it was actually a very shrewd move. Wurmser's remaining troops were already in the process of moving south, in preparation for an offensive into the Po Valley from the east. Now that Napoleon was moving north, that offensive would be aimed into his rear, and there would be very few French troops standing between the Austrian army and Mantua. Wurmser believed Napoleon would have no choice but to turn around and race south to face him, or else allow the Austrians to advance into his rear, cut his lines of supply, and link up with the Mantua garrison. Bonaparte learned of Wurmser's movements on September 5th, and immediately understood the choice before him. But, as always, Napoleon had no intention of doing what was expected. Rather than falling back south, he settled on a much riskier course of action. He would leave 10,000 men to garrison Trent, and the rest of the army would depart to confront Wurmser. But rather than going back the way they came, Napoleon would go east, following Wurmser's army down the same route. This maneuver was dangerous. The army of Italy would be stretching its supply and logistics systems to the limit, and operating in territory where there was little chance of foraging for food or supplies. The Austrians knew this territory well, and were experienced in Alpine warfare. If Wurmser stayed ahead of the Republicans, he might be able to link up with the garrison of Mantua before Napoleon could force a battle, which would give the Austrians a significant numerical advantage. But there were massive potential upsides to this strategy as well. Wurmser would not be expecting such an unconventional maneuver. His lines of communication and resupply back to Vienna would be cut off, and the Austrians were much more reliant on outside supplies than the lean army of Italy. This was just the type of risk Napoleon liked taking. He had seen how tough and adaptable the army of Italy was compared to their opponents. They thrived in unconventional, fluid situations, while the Austrians were thrown off balance. And so, by throwing out the rulebook, embracing improvisation, and creating chaos and ambiguity, Napoleon gave himself an advantage. Bonaparte wasted no time, leaving Trent to chase Wurmser on September 6th, the day after he arrived. The Austrians had a 5-day head start, but once again, Napoleon trusted in his men's ability to outmarch the enemy, and once again, the army of Italy delivered. 2 days later, they were right on Wurmser's heels. Augereau's division caught up with the Austrian rearguard at the village of Primolano and dealt them a nasty defeat, inflicting over 2,000 casualties and setting off a minor panic at Wurmser's headquarters. The Austrian field army was strung out on the march, but with Augereau nipping at his heels, the old field marshal had no choice but to pull together as many units as he could to turn and face Bonaparte, to keep the French off his back and buy a little time. The Austrians would be badly outnumbered. Wurmser could call upon only 11,000 men to face 20,000 Republicans. But he chose the location for this battle carefully. The pursuing French were divided by the Brenta River, 10,000 troops on each bank. The only crossing points in the vicinity were at the village of Bassano, and so this is where Wurmser would make his stand. It seemed like a good idea on paper, keeping the French divided, but clearly there was some kind of communication breakdown between Wurmser and his subordinates, because when the two armies faced off on September 8th, the Austrians neglected to properly guard one of the bridges over the Brenta. Napoleon quickly seized the bridge and united his forces for a massive assault on the main Austrian position. With the advantage of numbers and speed, they quickly overran the enemy line around Bassano and pushed into the rear of Wurmser's army. Napoleon's closest friends distinguished themselves in this battle. Brigadier General Lannes personally led the assault into Bassano, and Brigadier General Murat commanded the cavalry in a devastating pursuit into the Austrian rear. The fighting was over quickly. In the battle itself, the French lost around 400 killed or wounded. Austrian casualties were slightly higher. But, as is often the case with Napoleonic warfare, the real damage was done in the pursuit. Several hundred more Austrians were killed or wounded, and as many as 4,000 more were forced to surrender. Several high-ranking officers were captured, including a major general, a rare feat. Our old friend, Marshal Peter Kwasdanovich, commanded the division which bore the brunt of Napoleon's attack. After the battle, Kwasdanovich compounded his defeat by disobeying orders and retreating south with the remains of his division, rather than rejoining the main body of Wurmser's army, thus depriving the Austrian offensive of his 3,000 troops. The Battle of Bassano was an unmitigated disaster for the Austrians. However, with Napoleon blocking his only line of retreat back to Austria, Wurmser had no choice but to keep up the advance into Italy with his dangerously depleted field army of only around 15,000 men. But he had gained one vital advantage from his defeat at Bassano: information. The battle had forced Napoleon to show his hand. Wurmser now had confirmation that the vast majority of the army of Italy was either in his rear or back at Trent, over a week's march from the action. That meant there was not very much standing between the Austrian field army and Mantua. And that meant Wurmser still had a chance. For once, his intuition was correct. As we discussed, the only significant bodies of French troops left in northern Italy were the 6,000 men besieging Mantua itself, and Kilmaine's 3,000 men, spread out across the Adige River. If Wurmser could reach Mantua and link up with the 17,000 Austrian troops in the city, he could replenish his forces, and would be in a good position to force Napoleon to fight a battle on favorable terms. But if Napoleon caught his outnumbered, demoralized army before they could reach the city, surrender or destruction would be the likeliest outcomes. For once, the Austrians got the jump on the French. Napoleon misinterpreted Kwasdanovich's retreat to the south. Maybe he underestimated Wurmser's boldness, or maybe he overestimated the magnitude of his victory at Bassano. Whatever the case, he expected the whole Austrian field army to abandon the offensive and retreat south. On the evening of September 8th and morning of the 9th, the army of Italy moved to pursue the enemy this direction. Meanwhile, Wurmser concentrated his remaining troops and continued eastward. It was only a few hours before Napoleon's scouts discovered the mistake, and the army of Italy rushed to redeploy east. but the damage was done. The next few days of the campaign were a race to Mantua, and Wurmser now had a crucial head start. The first leg of this race would be from Bassano to the village of Lenyago, the nearest crossing point over the Adige River. Lenyago had been garrisoned by part of Kilmaine's force, but Napoleon had already ordered them to redeploy elsewhere, and the bridge was now unguarded. Bonaparte knew there was no hope of reaching Lenyago before the Austrians, so he ordered Massena's division to cross the Adige elsewhere and attempt to strike Wurmser's army just after they crossed at Lenyago, hopefully confining them to a small bridgehead and stopping the advance. Meanwhile, Augereau would approach from behind, trapping the Austrians at Lenyago. Under normal circumstances, it was pretty safe to bet on a revolutionary French army beating an Austrian army in a foot race. But Napoleon had already pushed the army of Italy nearly to the point of exhaustion to catch the Austrians at Bassano, and his miscalculation after the battle had simply given Wurmser too big a lead. The men made a valiant effort. In the space of 6 days, Massena's division covered about 100 miles, or 160 kilometers. Augereau and his men traveled 115 miles, or 185 kilometers. But it was no use. By September 11th, Wurmser was over the Adige. Massena's division was not even close. Which may have ultimately been for the best for the French. If Massena had arrived in time to offer battle, his men would have been completely exhausted and outnumbered by nearly 50%. The result could easily have been disaster. After crossing the Adige, all that lay between Wurmser and Mantua was 45 kilometers, or 27 miles, of open country, and then he would have to find some way to cross the lakes into the city. There was also the matter of the 6,000 French troops besieging the city. In theory, this was General Serrurier's division, but the old veteran fell desperately ill with malaria soon after the siege began, and he was still in France recuperating. Serrurier was temporarily replaced by his second-in-command, Brigadier General Pascal Fiorella. Fiorella was a Corsican, and actually a distant cousin of the Bonapartes. He led the division capably enough, although he was probably the one responsible for jumping the gun and throwing off Napoleon's timetable at Castiglione by attacking too early. But by now, Fiorella too had fallen ill with malaria, and he in turn was replaced by General Jean-Joseph François-Léonard Sauget. Sauget didn't come from within the army of Italy. He was a replacement sent from Paris. He had no experience fighting under Napoleon, and perhaps was unaware that Bonaparte expected his subordinates to seize the initiative. That might explain why Sauget did almost nothing to hinder Wurmser's final push into Mantua. With only 6,000 troops, he had little choice but to pull his men back. But as he did so, Sauget neglected to take even basic precautions, like destroying bridges or burning boats. And so, when Wurmser arrived outside Mantua on September 13th, he simply marched right into the city over the nearest bridge. For once, the Austrians actually won a foot race against the Army of Italy. Wurmser had finally reached his objective. Although, had he really? His mission was to relieve the garrison and lift the siege. That involves not merely entering the city, but actually re-establishing the lines of supply and communication cut off by the besiegers. That still had not been done. By the time Wurmser entered Mantua, Napoleon had been behind his army for the better part of a week. He himself was actually cut off. In effect, all he had really accomplished so far was burdening the city with well over 10,000 more mouths to feed. The fortress was built and provisioned to hold a little over 10,000 men. By September 12th, there were nearly three times that many Austrian troops inside Mantua. As Wurmser's army streamed into the city, carrying few supplies of their own, and with the French right on their heels, The men of the garrison probably wondered if they had arrived to rescue the city or merely to seek sanctuary. Wurmser's situation looked bleak, but he had no intention of sitting passively behind the walls and waiting for hunger and disease to bring about the inevitable surrender. Between his own troops and extra men from the garrison, he was able to put together an impressive new field army of over 20,000 men. The army of Italy was scattered and tired. For once, Napoleon's forces were divided and Wurmser's were united. Conditions had never been more favorable for a breakout from the city, and that's exactly what Wurmser planned to do. After taking a day to rest and reorganize, Wurmser took his new army out of Mantua to face the French. He easily brushed aside Sahugier's division and arranged his forces in an arc just north of the city, with his center anchored on the village of Due Castelli. This was a strong defensive position, and Wurmser knew the French would not be able to pass up a chance to fight the Austrians on open ground without the protection of Mantua's walls. As Wurmser prepared his lines, Massena's division was approaching the city. Sure enough, he joined forces with Sahugier and prepared for an immediate attack. The French captured Due Castelli, but the Austrians launched a ferocious counterattack, which retook the village. Bloody fighting continued all day, but neither side budged. After dusk, the two armies fell into an uneasy pause, gathering their strength to continue the battle the next morning. Wurmser awoke at dawn on September 15th from dreams of Massena's destruction. The French were outnumbered, and they had gotten the worse of the previous day's hard fighting. But during the night, Napoleon himself had arrived, along with Augereau's division of 10,000 men, and he had other plans. The French greeted the morning with attacks on both Austrian flanks. Wurmser was forced to take troops from his center to counter the threat. Napoleon then ordered Massena's battered division back into action, and, despite their condition, they punched right through the weakened Austrian center. With his line shattered, Wurmser had no choice but to fall back behind the walls of Mantua. This engagement has gone down in history as the Battle of San Giorgio, after a nearby suburb. The French lost around 1,500 casualties, and the Austrians around 2,500. More importantly, Wurmser lost his best opportunity to break out of the city. After San Giorgio, he was truly trapped. With the entire army of Italy sitting right on his doorstep, there would be no chance of another breakout anytime soon. Of course, that situation couldn't last forever. Inevitably, there would be a new Austrian offensive or new orders from Paris, and Napoleon would be drawn away from Mantua. But in the meantime, there were well over 20,000 men inside the city, eating through supplies meant for 10,000. The daily rations of the Austrian soldiers got smaller and smaller. The men got thinner and weaker. With malnourished troops living in cramped conditions, disease flourished. Mantua had become more a prison than a stronghold. Shortly after the Battle of San Giorgio, Napoleon sent one of his aides, Joseph Sulkovsky, into Mantua under a flag of truce. He told the Austrians that he had been sent to negotiate an exchange of prisoners, which was true, but Napoleon also gave him a secondary, secret mission. Sulkovsky came from western Poland and could speak German like a native. He was ordered to eavesdrop on the Austrians and learn all he could about the mood and conditions within the city. Sulkovsky's report painted a bleak picture. He estimated 60% of the officers were sick or wounded, and said the conversations he overheard sounded like complaints of old invalids at the home for retired soldiers. By December, the garrison ran out of meat and resorted to slaughtering horses for protein. Around half of Wurmser's troops were now unfit for duty. If the men inside Mantua were to be saved, it would take some outside intervention. They were now too weak to save themselves. And so, Field Marshal Count Dagobert von Wurmser's time as chief antagonist of our story ends with a whimper, not a bang. He'll remain in command for several months longer, but over an army that grew smaller and weaker by the day, without any freedom of action. Wurmser fought Napoleon for about 2.5 months. He gave the army of Italy a few real scares, but failed to win a single major victory. Neutralizing Wurmser and bringing Mantua closer to surrender was a significant achievement for Napoleon. But if you'll recall the beginning of the episode, he was actually supposed to be in the north, supporting General Moreau's push through southern Germany. As things turned out, it was maybe for the best that the Army of Italy was too distracted to involve itself in Moreau's offensive. The Directory had imagined Bavaria would be the springboard for further advances into the Habsburg heartlands. But it turned out to be the high tide of French operations in Germany. While Napoleon chased Wurmser through the Alps, Moreau's advance stagnated, and the Austrians counterattacked. The Army of the Sambre and Meuse and the Army of the Rhine and Moselle were both in full retreat. Between September 3rd and September 18th, French forces in Germany suffered no fewer than 5 major defeats. The French commanders on the German front had to contend with something Napoleon didn't: energetic, forward-thinking Austrian leadership. Every opponent Napoleon has faced so far was much older. Colley was 58, Beaulieu was 70, and Wurmser was 72. They varied in their styles and levels of competence, but all three came from an earlier generation. They learned to fight a style of warfare that was slow, predictable, and limited in scope compared to Napoleonic warfare. The Austrian military was conservative, and it didn't have the massively high turnover of the revolutionary French army, and so most of its leadership fit this profile. The new Habsburg commander-in-chief in Germany was the exception. His name was Archduke Karl Ludwig Johann Joseph Laurentius von Österreich, Duke of Teschen. Obviously, that's a bit of a mouthful, so in English, we usually refer to him simply as Archduke Charles. He was only 25 years old, and felt perfectly at home in this new, fast-paced, improvisational type of warfare. So, how does a forward-thinking 25-year-old rise to such a position of prominence within a hidebound institution like the Austrian military? Well, Charles really was a good soldier, but his rise probably had more to do with the fact that he was the son of the Holy Roman Emperor Leopold II, and younger brother of the current emperor, Francis II. Archduke Charles's Habsburg genes didn't do him any favors. He was just barely over 5 feet tall, short even by the standards of the day. He had a prominent nose and beady little eyes that got lost under a gigantic forehead. He suffered from epilepsy and was prone to illness. Despite his frail constitution, Charles was groomed from childhood for service in the military, as was typical for younger sons of Austrian emperors. Obviously, he had his career handed to him on a silver platter, but Charles took military life seriously. He was happy to take early promotions and use his clout with his brother to influence strategy, but he did not exploit his position to shirk the responsibilities of command or to obtain personal safety or comfort. Despite his immense privilege, Charles was a brave and diligent soldier, not above doing hard work or leading from the front. He was 20 years old when the War of the First Coalition began, and already a brigadier general. It's remarkable how quickly someone blessed by both ability and nepotism can rise. I'm sure some of his men had reservations about going into battle under an awkward little 20-year-old who owed his position to his family, but Charles performed well from the very beginning, outshining many older and more experienced Austrian commanders. In an era of revolutionary changes on the battlefield, experience became almost more of a liability than an asset. As a young man, at the very beginning of his career, Charles had few old habits to change, and less outdated knowledge to unlearn than his older colleagues. And, of course, with his brother to back him up, he was free to deviate from orthodoxy without fear of ruining his career. And so, Archduke Charles embraced modern warfare more quickly and enthusiastically than anyone in the Austrian military. Charles's modern outlook earned him plenty of enemies within the deeply conservative Austrian court and military high command. Perhaps they saw flashes of his uncle, Emperor Joseph II, whose zeal for progress gave new meaning to the term enlightened despotism, and had almost torn the empire apart with his aggressive reforms. Many of Austria's generals and field marshals bristled at taking orders from a man young enough to be their grandson, but they could do little more than grumble in private. Not only was he the emperor's brother, he soon proved to be one of the only Austrian commanders capable of reliably beating the revolutionary armies on their own terms. Historians sometimes overestimate Archduke Charles. He wasn't a genius. Even in his best campaigns, he made obvious mistakes and suffered defeats. But he was intelligent, competent, and most importantly, he understood that the nature of warfare had changed better than anyone else in the Austrian high command. He had the power and connections to fight the way he wanted, and, as we'll see later in his career, to bring the Austrian army kicking and screaming into the future. Archduke Charles would continue hammering the French all through the fall and winter of 1796. In Germany, the momentum of the war had shifted back to the Austrians. Down in Italy, Napoleon's struggles were far from over. Despite the setbacks in September, Vienna was still not prepared to give up on Mantua. While Wurmser and his men languished behind the walls, the Austrians were assembling a new field army to mount yet another attempt to relieve the city. But that story will have to wait for next episode. Until then, thanks for listening.